This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. I am Deepak Singh. On the day before Virginia's presidential primary, students in Larry Sabato's American Politics 101 class were treated to one of the two main candidates left in the race, New York Senator Hillary Clinton. The venue for the class was changed to Old Cabell Hall to accommodate the crowd. Before Clinton spoke, Sabato commented on the role his class can play in American politics.
Senator, we've had three presidents in this class over the years. We were talking about my 38 years here and the fact that I'm part of the furniture. We've had 100 governors and senators. We've had Presidents Carter, Ford, and Reagan over the years. We don't count Thomas Jefferson. Maybe he was the fourth. And who knows? Maybe it's possible we're adding a fifth here today. Now, oh, there you go. Senator, I remember a crisp, cold day 15 years ago that I know you recall better than I do. Thousands of people, including many of us here in this auditorium, joined you and your husband up at Monticello in mid-January of 1993 as you started your bus trip to the January 20th, 1993 inauguration. You've had an incredible ride, really a magical mystery tour in the decade and a half since, and we're just thrilled that one of the stops on that tour is now ours. You're literally, I think, one of the dozen most instantly recognized people in the entire world. And so we're so lucky to have you here today at the University of Virginia. We're not going to waste a minute more. The students have tons of questions. I do want you to know that you were on 60 Minutes last night being interviewed by one of my very first students, Katie Couric, who lived right down the lawn, right near here. So I'm going to ask everybody here in the auditorium to join me in giving a warm University of Virginia welcome to the two-term former First Lady, the two-term current United States Senator from the great state of New York, and we all know the Democratic candidate for President of the United States, Hillary Clinton.
Thank you. Thank you all. Well, it is great being here, and I'm very glad to have this opportunity to come and be part of this class. It is quite a famous class. Not only governors and senators and presidential candidates, but on a weekly basis, people coming in, talking about American politics, talking about what politics is, how it works, what it should be. Actually, one of my favorite quotes is one of your quotes, Larry, that politics is good. You know, because in a democracy, if it's not, we are in deep trouble. And obviously, as human beings, we know, as our founders, particularly Mr. Jefferson would remind us, we are often, you know, pulled and pushed by the various appetites and desires of human nature, and it's constantly necessary to balance all of that within our political system.
At this point in Senator Clinton's appearance, a power failure knocked out the recording equipment being used to supply the audio feed to the media. Our recording picks up after a few minutes, with Clinton continuing her theme of the role of democracy in the United States.
There is no guarantee we remain great and good. It really is up to us. And in our democracy, the process that we have to make that happen is the political system. So your being in this class and your coming here today is very important to me, because I want more and more young people involved in every way, from exercising your right to vote, which I hope you will all do tomorrow, to being part of campaigns, to being involved in issues, maybe someday even thinking about running for office yourself. That's how we will regenerate the character and spirit of this great country. So with that, Larry, let's throw it open.
Wonderful, Senator. Thank you very, very much for those opening comments. And now we're expecting great things from the students of Politics 101. We'll see who's brave and who wants to get an A.
Oh, that should be a motivator.
There we go. I saw. So he didn't raise his hand until I said an A.
Yeah, I heard that.
Okay.
From here on out, we have tried to recover the sound of the questions where possible. The first question was not picked up on the microphone, so we will paraphrase it here. The student asked what has caused Clinton to change her position on issues over the course of campaign.
Wonderful question. You know, when I started running for the Senate back in 99, I said that I wanted to travel throughout New York and listen, because I think you learn more when you listen than when you talk. And it was an extraordinary experience. You know, obviously, I learned a lot about issues I didn't know anything about. You know, New York has 34,000 family farms, mostly dairy, fruit, and vegetable. So I listened, and I learned about what life was like and what the challenges were. A lot of the old industrial base there has been battered by the changes in the global economy. What worked? What didn't work? What should we try next? So it's a constantly evolving process. And in this campaign, starting out now a little over a year ago, it is the most personal and even intimate experience to be invited into people's lives. People will tell someone running for office about losing their job or losing their health care or on the brink of losing their home that they wouldn't tell their neighbor and they wouldn't tell somebody at work. It's a combination of, you know, the hope that maybe something can be done to help me and just a desire that, you know, somebody hear me, see me, know what I'm going through. And so during the course of this, I'll give you a couple of quick responses. I've always been committed to universal health care. You know, I took this issue on back in 93 and 94. It's very challenging. There were a lot of people in the world of the pundits as well as in the campaign world who said to me, no, really, don't go there again. You know, don't come up with a universal health care plan because that's so controversial. It is difficult. It will trigger all of the, you know, responses from Republicans, from the health insurance industry. But the more I went out and listened, the more convinced I became that this is a value worth standing up for. And it was because of the stories people told me. You know, how could I in my own mind even imagine coming up with a plan that left, you know, the mother standing in front of me whose son was born with a congenital heart condition who's already had 4 surgeries. They don't have insurance. They're uninsurable with that little boy. If it weren't for a program I helped to start, you know, back in 98 called the State Children's Health Insurance Program, they'd have no care for him. So listening both reinforces what you believe but maybe need to just get some extra motivation for. It teaches you about things like family farms in New York that you didn't know before, that you want to learn and that you want to be able to understand to help. And so it's a constantly evolving experience, and it's the best way to be in politics. If you go into politics believing you have all the answers, I don't think you're going to serve your constituents well, and I sure don't think you're going to be solving problems. And there are a lot of people who take that position for ideological reasons or partisan reasons. You can't move them. You can't budge them. Facts don't mean anything. I think facts are important. I think facts are stubborn. I think you actually have to look at the facts. I'd like to get back to after George Bush, which would be a nice change.
Thank you very much. Now, all right, I'm going to call on you, and I want you, as this gentleman did, always tell Senator Clinton who you are and where you're from. That's helpful. And speak loudly so that everybody knows what you're asking.
And my question is just, they just released a study that said that biofuel might be more damaging to the environment than fossil fuels. And I was just wondering, with the whole movement towards a cleaner and greener future, how do you work in biofuel, which has been, you know, promoted by most presidential candidates? Thank
Great
you.
Question. Let's talk a little bit about energy and global warming, because the biofuel issue sort of fits into that, and I don't want to talk about it in isolation. Earlier today, I was at a GM plant outside of Baltimore that is making a new transmission for hybrid cars. And it's a big investment by GM. And they're really making significant progress in trying to get to a commercially available fleet that will, as they say, go from gas-friendly to gas-free. In the gas-friendly category are biofuels. And there is evidence that you don't get as much energy out of certain forms of bio-based fuel like corn, bio-based fuel. So I think you have to look at biofuels not in a singular way, only thinking about corn ethanol, which is our primary product right now, but to look at what's being done in Brazil with sugarcane, which has a higher energy production payoff, which therefore means that the investment is much more effective because you're going to get more energy out of it than you put into it. The problem is with a lot of these production facilities for biofuels, you have to use old carbon-based energy, or people are traditionally using them at this moment in order to produce the energy you need. So this is a complicated equation. We need to move more toward more efficient forms of biofuel, and I think cellulosic material has a greater potential return than corn does, probably even than sugarcane does. You've heard people talk about switchgrass, fast-growing willows, certain forms of cacti. We have just begun to scratch the surface about how to liberate the energy, which is primarily solar energy, you know, created through photosynthesis, how to liberate that from plant life and put it to work in fueling our vehicles. So ethanol from corn isn't the most efficient, but it's what we have to start with. And the reason why I think it is appropriate to start there is because we have to build a base, a commercial market for the use of ethanol. And as we do that, that means that car companies will create more flex fuel vehicles. GM told me today they have 2.5 million on the road. They have a lot more in Brazil because Brazil now is practically independent of foreign oil using their sugarcane ethanol. And we have to create the distribution system. You know, gas stations are going to have ethanol pumps, which the vast majority don't yet. So I see corn ethanol as a necessary first step. There is an environmental cost to pay because it uses a lot of water, and it does use a lot of energy in return for what you actually get out of it. But we can, building that base, then transition to other forms of biofuel. And I think it's something we do have to subsidize at the time being. You know, we've always subsidized different forms of energy. We subsidize oil. We subsidize natural gas. We subsidize coal. We subsidize nuclear. We have to shift those subsidies to alternative fuels, both for transportation and for electricity. So I think that biofuels have to be an important part of that mix, but we have to get more sophisticated as to how we produce the energy out of it and deliver the energy. And the final thing I would say about that is I think we have to approach this in the same way that we approach the space race or the Human Genome Project. This has to be a very concerted investment strategy by the federal government in partnership with the private sector and universities like UVA. That's what we did following the launch of Sputnik. You know, when that went up, everybody was panicked that we were going to lose the space race to the Russians. Well, we didn't sit around and wring our hands. We began to make these investments, and the results paid off for decades. You know, when we decided to go into information technology, it was the government that, through the work of scientists, created the internet, and then we set it free and, you know, revolutionized information and communication. The same with the Human Genome Project. You know, now you would have private entities that could map the human genome, but when we started, the federal government was the only one with the resources. So we have to invest in these alternative forms of energy. And I would take the tax subsidies away from the oil companies. I think their days are over in terms of being subsidized. Their profits have been extraordinary. ExxonMobil made $40 billion in profit last quarter. We need to be taking that money and using it to accelerate cellulosic biofuels, looking at how we're going to transform fuel cells. We're making some progress, but we can accelerate that. So I think this is one of the most exciting prospects facing our country. We've got to have a president who is going to put it at the very top of the national priority list. I intend to make a new energy future, you know, a centerpiece of my administration so that we see the progress. Many of you will have an opportunity to actually participate in some way, both as individuals and perhaps professionally. But this has to be a united effort across our country to get us where we need to go with diminishing our dependence on foreign oil, dealing with global warming, which goes hand in hand. We can talk about that further, and jump-starting the economy. We can create millions of new good jobs if we do this right. So I'm very excited about what can come from our investments there.
All right, let me get this young lady right here.
Two of the things I've heard you talk about the most are universal health care and pulling troops out of Iraq immediately, both of which are going to be expensive projects. I was wondering what, if any, government programs you're thinking about cutting or downsizing to help pay for them.
Yes, well, I'm thinking about ending the war in Iraq, which will save us a lot of money. You know, the two important priorities you mentioned, universal health care and bringing our troops home from Iraq, are obviously both difficult. They're not easily accomplished. It's going to take very careful, responsible leadership to achieve both of those. But everything I have proposed in my campaign, you can go to my website, hillaryclinton.com. I will tell you how I pay for them. On universal health care, here is the sort of short version, because you have to understand what I'm trying to do to understand how I will pay for it. I believe that bringing down costs for everyone in health care and improving quality is essential to maintain and improve the overall functioning of our health care system. There isn't any doubt that we have, you know, by far the greatest university hospitals. We have the most accomplished physicians, nurses, healthcare professionals. But when you leave 47 million people out altogether, and when you leave tens of millions of more out because their insurance company won't pay for the healthcare they need, you have a system that is constantly being undermined. Because when somebody does go to the emergency room and finally get taken care of, it's usually later than it should have been, in the absence of preventive care. And the care and the cost of the care has to be covered somewhere. So it goes into our taxes, and it goes into the insurance premiums that people have to pay. We spend more than anybody in the world, and we don't get the best results on a lot of public health indicators. We don't have the longest lifespan, we don't have the best infant mortality, we don't treat chronic diseases the most efficient, effective ways. There's just a lot of evidence to that end. So what I'm proposing is pretty straightforward. If you have health insurance and you're happy with it, nothing will change. You will keep your policy and continue to do what you've done and pay what you've paid. But if you are uninsured or underinsured, you will now have the option to go into the congressional health plan. See, Congress has a very good plan for itself, for its staff, for federal employees, with over 250 options. And on average, it is cheaper than what you can buy through your employer or in the open market. And the reason is because you have many millions of people participating in this plan, which means you can control costs better, you can get discounts, you can drive a better bargain. And it's also because taxpayers pay 75% of the cost of your congressman's health care. So we're going to open it up and give people the opportunity to actually buy a policy that would meet their needs. And if they can't afford it completely, we will provide health care tax credits, and we will limit the amount of money that anyone has to pay for a premium to a low percentage of your income. That will take about $110 billion up front. Where would the money come from? It will come, number one, from letting President Bush's tax cuts on people making more than $250,000 a year expire. That is about $55 billion a year. It's a very small percentage of our income, but obviously it's a lot of money. That money will be combined with the kinds of policy changes and efficiency savings that are there for the picking in the healthcare system. A couple of quick examples. You live your lives on computers. You buy and sell, you communicate, you go to the bank and punch in a number, you get money out. But if you go to your doctor, it's a pen and paper world still. Medical records are stored in file cabinets, they're in desk drawers. They are not part of the 21st century communication system. If we had, as I've been advocating for now for 5 years, an electronic medical record system where you would have access to a secure, privacy, confidentiality guaranteed set of your medical records that you would own, not your doctor, you would own, then we would save in redundancy, mistakes, lost time of people giving their history for the 50th time, all that we do in the healthcare system that is so inefficient. We would save, according to the RAND Corporation, $77 billion a year. If we gave Medicare the right to negotiate for lower drug prices, we would save billions of dollars. If we cut the subsidies that the Bush administration and the Republican Congress gave to the HMOs through Medicare, we would save billions of dollars. So we would get $55 billion from the tax change, $55 billion from the savings. That would cover us being able to provide health insurance to everybody. You know, Paul Krugman, who some of you might read in the New York Times, other economists, other independent evaluators, have said that my plan will reach universal coverage, and it's quite cost efficient. It's one of the big differences in this race between Senator Obama and myself, because he doesn't have a plan for universal health care. And I think that is unfortunate, because I believe that if you don't start trying to achieve universal health care, you'll fall way short. So I have a plan to do that, paid for. With respect to the war in Iraq, we are spending so much money now on Iraq that as we begin to withdraw our troops, we will immediately see the savings accrue to us from that. And obviously we can talk about Iraq later, but you know, Secretary Gates said today that he doesn't see us taking any more troops out, which means we will have the same level of troops in the summer of 08 that we had in the beginning of 07. I think that is a mistake. I think it's a mistake on several grounds. There is no military solution. Our young men and women have done the very best job that anybody could expect. They've fulfilled every mission, but they cannot force the Iraqis to reconcile. The whole point behind the surge was to get the Iraqi government to make these tough decisions, which so far they have refused to do. I have said many times that I think if we begin to withdraw, the Iraqi government will be forced to start making decisions that will determine what kind of future they will have. So, yes, there will be some front-end cost, but within several months, we will be saving money, and we will be bringing that money home to be used right here in the United States, which is where it should be used.
All right, let's get you right here.
Who was the most influential person in your political career?
Who was the most influential person in my political career? You know, it's a little hard to answer because I never thought I would run for office. I never imagined I'd be sitting here running for the Democratic nomination for president. But I always was interested in politics. I would have been in your class if I had come to UVA because I really was fascinated by how this cumbersome democracy of ours kept going and got it mostly right most of the time. And so I was always reading about and studying about American political figures. Obviously, I admire a lot of the presidents in times past. I, as a young girl, was fascinated by, you know, the Roosevelts and what they both did on behalf of our country. And, you know, every generation, every era, you look at the people who are in the public eye and they can be influential about how you think. You know, both President Kennedy and President Johnson, you know, really, for very different reasons, coming from extremely opposite poles, were very influential in both lifting my sights and thinking about what was possible and delivering results. So, I mean, you just learn all the time. So I would be hard pressed to point to any one person. I have been influenced by so many people whom I have learned from. You know, I worked in my first political job that I was ever hired for was in 1972 when I was hired by the Democratic National Committee to register Hispanic voters in the Rio Grande Valley in Texas and all along South Texas. And I met people there who influenced me because that was a new experience. You know, in 1976, I worked for President Carter in his election campaign, and I learned a lot from that. Obviously, we had a bit of a dry spell from 1980 to 1992 in terms of Democrats being elected, But I was deeply involved in the work that my husband did in Arkansas, you know, trying to improve education, trying to improve health care. And I believe that the political figures whom I admire most are the ones who I believe understand the core values of America, what it is we're called to do. I think America's common purpose is progress. It is trying to, you know, make tomorrow better than today, trying to give people a chance to live up to their God-given potential. So those are the kinds of political leaders I admire. Now, around the world, someone who had an enormous influence on me was Nelson Mandela. I was privileged to get to know him well, spend a lot of time with him, and I'll just tell you a quick story because this had a profound impact on me. I was part of the anti-apartheid movement. I was, you know, someone who tried to get corporations to disinvest from South Africa and to get political leaders to take stands against any kind of political or business relationships with South Africa under the apartheid regime. So when Nelson Mandela walked out of jail, you know, I remember watching that on television and just, you know, being so overwhelmed by, you know, this moment that had come. And then shortly after that, a few years after that, he was elected president, and I was one of the leaders of the delegation, along with Vice President Gore, to go to South Africa to represent our country at his inauguration. And I had met him a few times before that, but, you know, it had been kind of in a casual setting, and I hadn't really had a chance to get to know him well. So we go to the inauguration, and, you know, the Vice President Gore and Mrs. Gore and I, you know, started by going to the presidential residence to meet with the outgoing ANC leadership, because if it hadn't been for them, there might not have been a peaceful transition of power. So we had breakfast with them, and we went to the inauguration, and then we came back, and the transformation was astonishing. You know, we turned into this long drive, and where it had been very sedate and staid, now it was filled with people dancing and singing from all over South Africa. And we go into this residence where there are people from VIPs from literally all over the world who had helped Mandela and helped, you know, the struggle against apartheid. And then we went to a big tent where the luncheon was held. And, you know, there were people, I mean, kings and prime ministers and presidents and all kinds of distinguished visitors. So Nelson Mandela stood up, and he was making his remarks. He said, "I'm very honored to have all of you distinguished visitors here from around the world. But there are three people here whom I personally invited that I would like to introduce to you." And he proceeded to introduce three of his former jailers from Robben Island. He asked each of these men to stand up. He said, "You know, I was there for 27 years. I spent my days breaking rock, lime rock. The lime dust would fly into my eyes. We were often deprived of adequate nutrition and exercise, and it became just a daily struggle. And I knew," he said, "that if I left prison embittered and full of hate, I would still be in prison. But during those years, there were several people who saw me as a human being, who would talk to me, who would maybe say a kind word or find an extra bowl of oatmeal for me in the morning." He said, "And these three men were particularly important in that regard." He said, "One thing I've learned from being imprisoned all those years is that you have to give up whatever hate you have. You have to learn how to forgive." And it was just one of the most profoundly personal experiences. And then later I went to Robben Island with him. I spent a lot of time with him. I remember one day we were flying out of Robben Island on a South African helicopter, and when he came into office, he left the army in place, he left the police in place, which was predominantly white, Afrikaner. He said, "We're all South Africans, we're all going to work together, we're all going to learn how to live together." So we're getting into this helicopter, and this sort of burly South African colonel
helps Nelson Mandela into the helicopter, and President Mandela says, he takes very good care of me. And the colonel looks up at him and says, because you are South Africa. And you know, that kind of humanity, that understanding of what it takes to withstand the worst, to believe that it can get better, but that it doesn't get better by accident, it gets better because people try, they make commitments, they show courage. But if you don't leave all of the pain and misery behind, whether it's your personal life or the life of a country, you never get beyond. So probably that was the most influential lesson I have ever learned from a political leader.
This young lady right here.
It seems obvious to me that faith and religion are playing a big role in the current administration and the current government. And a lot of the other candidates have addressed that issue, not only in their personal lives, but how they see it affecting their administration if they are to be elected. And I just think
speaking to faith and religion, you know, I have addressed this quite often, but not as a political issue, but as, you know, who I am, what I believe, what I think is important. You know, I was raised and remain a Methodist. I have a long family tradition in the Methodist Church, and we are a denomination, a Protestant denomination, that believes very strongly that it has to be both personal faith and salvation, and the works that give life to your faith. You know, obviously one of my favorite scriptures is, you know, faith without works is dead, but I have lived long enough to know that works without faith is too hard. So I get a lot of support and sustenance from my faith. People ask me all the time if I'm a praying person. And I have been fortunate all my life to be one because of my parents and because of how I was raised. But I also am quick to add that, you know, if I had not been a praying person, living a week in the White House would have turned me into a praying person. So you have to have those, you know, those sources of strength. And for me, among them is very central to who I am, is my faith. I also believe totally in the separation of church and state. I think that is good both for the church and for the state. I think we have remained a very religious country in large measure because we have had the separation of church and state. We trace that back to Virginia with you know, some of the early decisions were made here even before we were a country. To respect freedom of conscience, freedom of religion. And I believe with all my heart that that is an important principle to be protected and defended in the United States. Now, that doesn't mean that faith has no role in the public arena. You know, we all come to difficult decisions about what we believe, what our values are. But I think it's important for anyone in public life, and most particularly the president, not to assume that we have all the answers. You know, I don't think faith can provide all the answers. That's not my tradition. That's not what I believe. I think we were given the ability to reason for a reason. And we have to continue to look at the evidence, think through the difficult choices we have. So I am very committed to my own personal faith. It informs me a lot about what I do. You know, going back to health care, I mean, I just think it's immoral to deny people health care in America. I mean, I think that is wrong. And that's partly rooted in what I believe and the values that I was taught as part of how I was raised. But I also think that a president has to be respectful of and understanding of the many faith and the lack of faith traditions in our country. So I do talk about my faith. I talk about how it informs me. I believe that it's an important part of how I make decisions, but I also am strongly committed to respecting that separation that I think is rooted very rightly and strongly in our Constitution, both for the sake of our state and the sake of our religious institutions, and I will continue to do that.
All right, this fellow right here in yellow.
Virginia. Senator Clinton, there have been a number of critical op-eds and resounding public opinion, as well as some polls, that indicate if you were to be the nominee, we should all look back for a Republican in the White House in 2009. Washington Post columnist George Will writes, "The surest way to unify the Republican Party is for the Democrats to nominate Hillary Clinton." With the race for the presidential nomination being as close as it is, what would you expect the reaction to be if the margin by which you may lead Senator Obama at the convention is in a number of superdelegates, people with whom you and your husband have had political access to, far in excess than your opponent?
Well, first of all, you won't be surprised to hear I don't agree with hardly anything George Will says. And I'm always on the lookout for a little disinformation that might be going on. You know, let's talk politics for a minute, because obviously you all are taking a course in politics, and it's of interest to you. I wouldn't be making this race if I didn't think I would be the best president, and I wouldn't be making it if I didn't think I was the best Democratic nominee to actually win in the fall. I believe that not just because it's me. I believe it based on, you know, my understanding of American politics, what we have to win in order to succeed against the Republicans, the fact that the likely Republican nominee will most apparently be Senator McCain. And I know what it will take for any Democrat to win. And clearly, I don't expect that the Republicans will give up the White House without a vigorous fight. You know, they're not about to say, well, you know, we have so messed it up, we should just leave it to the Democrats. I wish they would. I think that would be the polite thing to do, but I don't think that's going to happen. So we have to be... We have to figure out how we're going to win the electoral votes we need, and hopefully a comfortable margin beyond, to be in the White House. And if you look at the states that I have won, they are states we have to win. And they are states that I believe I will win in the general election. Obviously, Massachusetts, New York, New Jersey, Florida, Michigan, California, Arizona. I think that if you look at the base that I start from, because a lot of the caucus states, which you know are driven by the most active members of a political party, the people who show up at caucuses are people who are highly motivated and oftentimes, you know, very much on one issue or at least a certain ideological perspective. We're not going to carry, unless there's a tsunami change in American politics between now and then, we're not going to carry Alaska or North Dakota or Idaho or Nebraska. But we have to carry enough states on top of what John Kerry won to actually win. And I believe I'm in a much better position to do that. Because if you look at who I'm drawing votes from, it's people making less than $50,000 a year who need a president. That's going to be one of the greatest contrasts between me and Senator McCain. You know, I think he will have more of the same. He didn't even vote on the stimulus package. He has said he doesn't really understand the economy. Well, I think it's really important that the next president understand the economy and how to make it work for the vast majority of Americans. I have a huge vote among women, and women have formed the basis of Democratic victories. You know, the gender gap is real. I hope we can close it some. I'd love to see that happen, and I think it will once we get into a race against the Republicans. But it is a major bulwark of the Democratic Party, and it will be a huge benefit for me. I have also, as you know from reading this, been very successful with the Latino vote, which is critical in states we have to win. And maybe more than that, I think the idea that you can go into the general election and expect there not to be any negative attacks or any effort to sort of swift boat whoever our candidate is not realistic. Whichever of us is nominated will be subjected to the full force and effect of the Republican machine. That's what they know how to do. It will be back to their home base, and I believe I can withstand that better because I've been through it. You know, when you look at any general election matchup with the Republicans, they will not be shy about trying to paint whoever our nominee is in a way that will benefit them. That's what they're good at. They've done it before. They will try to do it again. There is very little, if any, new information about me. It has been processed. It is in the mental bank of America. And I think that's a huge advantage for me. And by the time the Republicans get done with whomever we nominate, you know, you will have a certain number of people who will be against you. That goes with the territory. But if we do our job, we'll be able to parry and push back and get more people to support us in light of what the consequences would be of another Republican presidency. I guess I have been through enough of these elections to understand what it's going to take to win. I have no illusions about bringing the country together in the absence of a fight. It's not going to happen just by hoping that it happens, because we're going to have a very formidable candidate against us with Senator McCain. And they will do everything they can to turn this election into another national security election. I think I can stand there on that stage with John McCain. He and I are on the Senate Armed Services Committee together. He's a friend of mine. I disagree with him on a lot of the positions he's taken. But I believe that I can cross what is ultimately the most important threshold you have to cross as a presidential candidate. You know, 40% of the people will be for you no matter who you are if you're a Democrat. 40% of the people will be for you no matter who you are if you're a Republican. We want to grow the electorate, but we have to convince people to see whoever our candidate is as being able to cross the commander-in-chief threshold. Because independent, undecided voters, that is what they're going to ultimately, whether it's expressed or implicit, have to determine. And I believe that, you know, I can cross that and have crossed that threshold, and therefore am in a much better position to sustain a very challenging campaign against both the candidate and the entire Republican machine. So I know why Republicans like Mr. Will might say that that's not the case, but I would take that with a pound of salt.
The fellow in the white shirt here.
I don't know if you remember, but myself and some of my classmates from Northport High School met with you back in March on Advocacy Day. We created the official 501c3, a Midwinter Night's Dream, raise money for ALS research. And my question is as follows. Much of the debate regarding the use of embryonic stem cells for medical research focuses on the principles of morality and ethics. How will you defend the morality of using embryonic stem cells for medical research against those who oppose doing so?
You know, I'm glad you asked the question, because some people sort of dismiss the ethical and moral concerns associated with embryonic stem cell research. And I think that is very unfortunate, because this raises serious questions. It's not an open or shut case. You have to really think through often competing values. There are competing moralities. People who are suffering right now from ALS, as you know so well. The way the bill that we've passed twice in the Congress is crafted is that the embryonic stem cells would be from embryos that would otherwise be discarded with the permission of those who have authority over them, usually the donors, maybe both a man and a woman, but at least whoever has the legal authority over them, would be, in effect, donating them for this research. There would not be any requirements. There would be no mandatory element to this. But there are thousands of stored embryos that will otherwise be discarded, that do hold out the promise through research of being able to treat and maybe cure or prevent some very debilitating chronic disease. I also am heartened by the research that is going on, which suggests that we may be on a path where stem cell research can be performed without embryos. We're not there yet, but there's been some very exciting findings by a couple of research universities in the last several months suggesting that we could use skin cells, other cells, and promote the kind of growth that would give us what we need for the research. So I think you have to conduct this research under very strict ethical standards. You know, we pass laws against human cloning with strong criminal elements. We've passed laws against soliciting the embryonic material. And we have to enforce those laws because this is one of those difficult lines to draw. But the argument really is that in the absence of making some use of these to-be-discarded embryos, we are denying the life and value of the life of people suffering from these very painful chronic diseases. Oftentimes in life, and you all know this, you have to balance different values. People come down differently after looking at that balance. I come down in favor of the structure of the law that we have passed, and I would sign that. But I would also be very clear that we have to safeguard this process and we have to be very strict about how it is actually implemented. But I think you've got morality on both sides of this argument, and that's basically where I think you can make your strongest stand.
All right, let me get, I can't see myself. Let me get, is that the young lady up there, right in the middle? I'm sorry, it's a guy. I couldn't see you. I apologize. Now I see why you wanted me to call on them.
I can see that.
To what extent do you intend to involve the UN inside the policy making of the US?
Well, I support America's involvement with the UN because if we didn't have the UN, we'd have to create something to take its place. I think the UN is desperately in need of reform. There were some good ideas that came forth when Kofi Annan was the Secretary General that we really haven't implemented. But I think that the UN serves so many important functions that often don't get much attention. You know, peacekeeping functions. We have UN peacekeepers across the world. Election monitoring functions. Things like enforcing the law of the seas. I mean, there's just so much that the United Nations does that is really beneficial to our interests in the United States. So I feel strongly that we've got to get the United Nations to function more effectively. It has to be cleaned up. The way it is structured is really an anachronism. It doesn't fully reflect the changing balance of power in the world. But I, for example, in thinking about withdrawing from Iraq, have said that we should have a United Nations high-level emissary to begin the process of overseeing refugees, of the flows of people inside Iraq and in and out of Iraq. There really wouldn't be anybody else able to do that if they were not there. We're working hard to get the UN peacekeeping troops into Darfur. It is painful. The Sudanese government is recalcitrant. They have no intention of cooperating if they can avoid it. But in the absence of the United Nations peacekeeping forces to supplement the African Union forces, we'd be nowhere. So it is frustrating, this negotiation with, working with the United Nations. But I don't see an alternative. So we should make the most of it instead of either withdrawing from it or, you know, trying to undermine it and replace it, because I don't think that's going to happen. I do believe we need other international organizations, because I don't think our international institutional support for what we need to do on global warming, on global terrorism, on public health, I don't know that it's up to the 21st century challenges. So I would like to take a hard look at all of these institutions, the UN, the IMF, the ILO, you know, we've got a bunch of alphabet soups that are involved in one way or another in various activities, and really to see if we can come up with a reform agenda that would make it more effective to deal with and work with the United Nations going forward. But I'm committed to doing that.
All right, let me see here. All right, way up here. You. Yes, you.
I'm Josh Jackson. I'm from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. My question for you is, who is your favorite Republican and why?
Well, I actually have a lot of favorite Republicans, but if I mention them, they'll all get in trouble. They'll probably be denied support or something by their party. You know, I've worked with a lot of Republicans over many years. And I have often found that on specific issues, there is so much common ground. You know, I worked with Senator Lindsey Graham from South Carolina to provide health care for National Guard and Reserve members, and it was a tough fight because the White House threatened to veto it and the Pentagon didn't want to pay for it. But we both came from very different perspectives and stood our ground and got it done. And, you know, that was a huge achievement to take care of people who take care of us. I've worked with Republicans. I've worked with Newt Gingrich on electronic medical records. And strange bedfellows, what can I say? And so there are a lot of Republicans that I have personal respect for, personal affection for. As I said, I've traveled with John McCain. He and I have gone to Iraq and Afghanistan together. We've tried to highlight global warming so that it was bipartisan to try to get more people to agree that we had to address it. And I feel in the Senate particularly, you really do get to know people on a personal basis. You know, it's a small group. It's 100 people. And you're with each other all the time. And I really find that many of the Republicans are personally very gracious, very supportive. And when you get to know someone personally, it really does destroy all the stereotypes. I wouldn't tell the story if he hadn't told it, but since he did, I will refer to it. You know, I was in the Senate for maybe, I don't know, 60 days, 90 days, and Senator Sam Brownback asked to come see me. And I didn't even have my permanent office yet. You know, when you go into the Senate or the House, I can't speak for the House, I'll speak for the Senate, you're sort of stuck into the basement or trailer until all of the offices are picked in order of seniority. And since you're on the bottom, it takes, you know, some months until you get your office. So I was still in the basement. And Sam came to see me, and he said, you know, I came to apologize. And I said, well, whatever for? He said, because I said terrible things about you, and I, you know, never even knew you before. I said, well, Sam, I'm sure I thought terrible things about you. So, I mean, you know, now that we know each other, maybe we can sort of set an example about how we should be able to have disagreements without being disagreeable. So there are a lot of Republicans with whom I have very close and personal relations. I have a lot of Republican business support in this campaign, you know, from New York and Chicago and other places. So I think it's important that we really try to respect each other's points of view, even if we disagree, even if we try to do everything we can to avoid those points of view being the majority, but at least try to maintain good personal relations. And I've been very pleased that I've been able to do that with a lot of people over the last 7 years.
All right, we have one more quick round, and then we're going to let Senator Clinton go to her TV appearance up in Northern Virginia or Maine. Maryland, rather. Yes, right there. This young lady.
Hello, I'm Ann Bowie, and I'm a Virginian. Just speaking of Mandela and humanity and representing your people well, 87% of American people believe that English should be the official language of the United States government. In May 2006, you voted against an amendment to a bill that made English the official language of government. When you vote against an absolute majority of Democrats, Republicans, Independents, Hispanics, and 400 years of United States history, how is your idea of change good for America?
Well, we've never had an official language. We've never had an official language. So actually, I think I'm on the side of the weight of history of America. We had a big debate at the beginning of our country whether German would be our official language, because there were a lot of German-speaking people in places like Pennsylvania. And we obviously adopted English as our common language. At the same time, I voted for English being our common national language. And I think that's exactly the right way to approach this. Because if you make English the official language, I represent New York. We have probably people from 170 countries, way over 150 languages and dialects. And there are those who say if it became an official language, the government couldn't pay for translators at the hospital or translators in the courtroom. You couldn't have ballots printed in Chinatown for people who have been here 50 years but whose English is not as good as it should be, and they deserve a right to vote because they're citizens. So I think that the question sort of suggests that if you make it an official language, you have to ask yourself, what are the consequences of that decision? And speaking as a New Yorker, speaking as someone who represents, you know, our great immigrant tradition, it would cause havoc in my city if all of a sudden the government were forbidden to fund anything in any language other than English. I think we've gotten along pretty well for all these years. I believe that part of what we have to do is get back to what worked in previous waves of immigration. Again, I'll take New York as an example. You know, at the turn of the 20th century, we were flooded with immigrants. There were opportunities to learn to speak English everywhere in New York City. You could go to your church. You could go to the local school. You could go to the union hall. You could go to the political hall. And we took very seriously our desire to get people to learn English. I have been promoting comprehensive immigration reform, and among the conditions that I would impose on people who would be given a chance, if they met these conditions over years, to become eligible for citizenship, is that they would have to try to learn English. But the very quick response is, we don't fund English-speaking classes the way we used to. We just don't have the range of services available that previous generations of Americans took advantage of. So I would like to do more to get more people to learn English, to use English. I want it to be our common national language. I've been for that. But I do not support making it an official language because I think that would cause a lot of unintended consequences that would not be good for our country, that would be very divisive, and would be very hurtful to people. You know, I do a lot of work in the hospitals in New York, and, you know, very often, you know, somebody comes in, they're here legally, they don't speak English very well, nobody knows their language. And it's hard enough. I don't want to make it any harder. So I just do not support that. And I think my position, you know, sometimes as a leader, you can't do what the majority of people want you to do. You got to do what you think is right. And that's why I voted the way I did.
You, this young lady.
Hi, my name is Jesus Sa. I'm from the Philippines. You are the first female who has come so close to the U.S. presidency. Do you think that you've come so far in spite of or because of your gender?
Well, the Philippines have had two women presidents, haven't you? You know, I don't know how to answer that question because I think it's probably a little of both. I think that running for president in the United States is the most demanding political undertaking in the world. There isn't any country that puts people running for president through what we put us through. It starts at the very beginning where you have to raise all this money. You know, it's obviously not a parliamentary system. And in a parliamentary system, you have a whole party apparatus to support whoever will end up being the prime minister. And whoever that person is only has to win her or his constituency. You have a tremendous series of, like an obstacle course you have to run. So I think it really comes down to who the person is and how resilient and confident, determined, effective, a person can be kind of running this obstacle course. But it takes a tremendous toll. I think it takes a toll on our country. It takes a toll on certainly the candidates. And it costs an enormous amount of money because we are a huge country. And to communicate with voters and to run modern campaigns is very expensive. So I think that what we have today with Senator Obama and myself is an extraordinary moment in history. We are both vying for the nomination of the oldest political party in the history of the world, and we are the result of all of the changes that have occurred for several generations that neither of us, you know, could be here without the sacrifice and commitment of those who came before. So I think that at the end of the day, you know, people really look at the two candidates or look at candidates and try to sort through what you agree with, what you don't agree with, what kind of leader you think the person is. But in this instance, we are both making history. And in making history, we are shattering stereotypes, shattering caricatures. You know, one of us will go on to be the nominee, but both of us, I think, have, you know, made a great contribution in sort of changing the way people not only in our country but around the world think about the American presidency. You know, now people will have in their mind's eye that, oh my gosh, you know, two people, you know, one a woman, one an African American, this has never happened before. But at the end of the process, I think it really comes down to the person. You know, are there people who won't vote because of gender or race? Maybe, I don't know. I hope we're getting beyond that. I think we are. But certainly people will try to sort out what each of us mean and what our candidacies represent. And we are trying to play catch-up, you know, because many other countries have had women presidents or women prime ministers. And, you know, obviously, I think it's time that the United States joined the rest of the world and made that happen here. So I'm going to keep working as hard as I can to earn those votes.
This young man right here, right through there. Yes, you.
Well, you've expressed one view of taxes, which is certainly the Republican perspective, and that is that the people who make the most and contribute the most in terms of income and wealth production shouldn't pay a progressive income tax. I just disagree with that. You know, I'm with Teddy Roosevelt on this. I think that the progressive income tax has served our country well. Because what's happened, and I think the facts that you don't include in your question are important. What has happened is that the top 10% of households in America have seen their wealth and income increase significantly over the last several years. In fact, 90% of all the wealth creation in America has gone to the top 10%. And much of that is in large measure due to the Bush tax cuts. You know, the Bush tax cuts clearly favored the wealthy and the well-connected. That was a political decision. I thought it was a mistake because the average middle-class family has lost $1,000 in income under George Bush. We've seen people fall back into poverty who had been lifted out of poverty during the 1990s. We don't see our country generating good jobs and increasing wealth among the vast majority, the 90% of who most of us represent in this nation. So, you know, this is a philosophical difference. My Republican friends say, you know, wealthy people deserve to keep as much of their wealth as possible. I don't think, with all due respect, rich people made America great. I think it's middle class and hardworking families that made America great. I think it's their contributions, generation after generation, that have created the opportunity society that I want to see continue. And my memory, and you know, it was 10 years ago, but my memory is that people did really well in the 1990s. And the tax system was a lot fairer. And we had a lot of millionaires and multimillionaires and billionaires, But we also had 22.7 million new jobs and more people lifted out of poverty than at any time in America's recent history. I think America works better when it works for everyone. Right now, it isn't working for everyone. It is working for those at the very top, but not everyone else.
We have time for just one more question, and I want this question to be fun and upbeat and maybe offbeat to end this particular class. So forget the heavy policy matters. All right, I see you better have it. I'll get you if you don't. Yeah, right there. Oh, you don't have it? Oh, you're nervous? You ought to be.
My name is Sam Davies, and I'm from New Canaan, Connecticut. Thank you very much. And I guess this is a little bit too serious of a question to end, but I'm still pretty curious, so I'm just going to go ahead and take the spotlight. But I'm the youngest of three kids, and it's going to cost my parents about $500,000 to send the three of us through college. And I'm just wondering, from a more personal college standpoint, how do you plan on making college more affordable? I know we take a lot of pride in our financial aid system and our scholarship programs, and I'm just wondering how you can help those who slip through the cracks make it through college.
Well, I'm really glad you asked that question. That's really important. And you know, your question is connected to the last gentleman's question. If you look at the profile of who's going to college today, it's a very different profile than it was 30 years ago. 30 years ago, the distribution of people being able to attend college, stay in college, and graduate from college cut across the income sectors of our society. It is much harder today for a student in the top 25% of his class, but the bottom 25% of income, to be able to piece together the money necessary to go to college than it is somebody in the top 25% of income, but the bottom 25% of his class. Because we haven't kept up with financial aid and scholarships commensurate with the increasing costs of college education. So now, on many campuses, the majority and a significant majority of students are from families making more than $100,000 a year. But that is by no means anything other than a relatively small percentage of our population. So I think this is one of the biggest problems confronting us, because we are shutting down the opportunity to go to college for a lot of people. We're putting families and kids at all income levels into lots of debt. So here's what I think we need to do. We need to have a tax credit. The one I've proposed would be $3,500 a year for each child for each year. We need much more direct grant money through programs like the Pell Grant, which is aimed at, you know, kids who don't have a lot of resources, whose families don't. I want to give back to the federal government the responsibility for direct lending. The student loan industry has compounded the costs of college dramatically. You know, I've been on lots of college campuses, and I ask people, what's the highest rate of interest that anybody's paying? And I was just shocked the other day when I was in Maine and somebody yelled out 29.7%. But I hear a lot of interest rates in the 20s, a lot of interest rates in the teens. When I went to law school, I couldn't afford it. My family couldn't help me. So I worked, as I had all through college, and I got a little scholarship. But then I borrowed money directly from the federal government under a program called the National Defense Education Act. And it was like 2% interest. And when I graduated, I could go to work for the Children's Defense Fund, which is what my passion was, and pay it back over time as a contingent of my income. So we want to make the interest rates much lower, get back to more direct lending, get the student loan companies off to the side or out of it. I'd like to see more national service, so that if you want to earn money, you can do 2 years of national service and earn up to $10,000 a year that you can put toward college. I would also like to help people who graduate with debt, and a lot of people do, in great amounts. I'd like to help people do a public service job and then pay off their debt over time. And for families like yours and so many others, we've got to streamline the process. You know, these financial aid forms that people fill out are cumbersome, and you get to the end of it after you've spent hours getting all the information, and you don't get anything for it. We can have a much more effective system by literally using the tax system to help people on a sliding scale. But I have been in so many different conversations You know, I've been with families who have literally mortgaged their homes to send their kids to school, a family that sold their home because otherwise they could not have afforded it. I just don't think that's right. I think we should make college, once again, affordable. I would like to see universities enter into a contract so that when you enter as a freshman, you have a set amount you will pay, and it cannot go up while you're there over the next 4 years. Otherwise, you know, families like mine and many of yours will scrape it together. It's a huge burden, but we'll come up with the money because we know it's a great opportunity to send our kids, but it is becoming less and less possible for a lot of people. And the other thing that I just want to remind everyone of is that the majority of young people your age will not go to college and graduate. 60% of people your age will not have a college degree. We do practically nothing for these young people. We don't do job training, apprenticeship programs. We don't do enough for community colleges. So I want to take a hard look at this whole opportunity ladder. We need to rebuild it. It worked really well for people my age and Larry's age. We had that kind of help. You know, we had a government that stood behind us, that helped us, you know, get through college. And I think we should again, because I don't want to lose young people who deserve to go and deserve to have a better chance. And I don't want to burden families so that they basically are indenturing themselves because they can't afford it. So we're going to try to make college affordable. That's one of my highest priorities.
Senator Clinton, I think that was a very relevant way to end this conversation. And what a great conversation it's been between a very substantive senator and presidential candidate, and I hope you'll agree, very substantive young people. Notice, if this had been a room full of pundits, we would only have asked you about the latest polls and the next election, but they're interested in real substance and real policy, and I think this is just a wonderful thing to have you come to the University of Virginia and engage these students in the way that you have. And we want to thank you in all the ways that we can, but one way that we like to thank people, I know you lived in one of Thomas Jefferson's houses for 8 years. They're a big white one in Washington. And you're the superstar here in Charlottesville today, but our permanent superstar is Thomas Jefferson. And, you know, you can never know enough about Thomas Jefferson. And believe it or not, because we know you have so much free time. I mean, what the heck are you doing, really? But you got all those coast to coast trips, right? And while you're flying, we've got a set of books. This is the Dumas Malone set, the ultimate biography of Thomas Jefferson. The best part is there'll never be a quiz on it for you, but I think you'll enjoy reading it. You have done so wonderfully today. We thank you more than you'll ever know for taking the time to be with us. Please give Senator Clinton the standing ovation she deserves.